You are listening to Adaptivate, a podcast that inspires industry leaders to leverage technology and new ideas to learn how to adapt, grow their businesses, and create better organizations. My name is Jeremy Miller, and I'm a marketer that currently works at GE Appliances, and I consider myself a student of business and innovation. I am talking with technologists, engineers, and business leaders about how their experiences have shaped their mindsets. In today's episode, we'll be speaking with Bob Miller, CEO of Tenafit, a company that delivers real-time connectivity solutions for cloud applications. Mr. Miller describes himself as a father, inventor, and an experienced executive that has spent decades supporting innovation-driven change. He also likes to say that every day you will touch a product that incorporates a technology in which he was instrumental. Hey, everybody, this is Jeremy Miller. I work for GE Appliances as the commercial director. And today I actually have a special guest, my father, Bob Miller, who is the CEO at Tenafit. And before we kind of get into our discussion today, Dad, I actually thought maybe you could give a little bit of background about your current company and what you guys are doing at Tenafit.
So Tenafit right now has a partnership with the University of Hawaii Research Center for Climate Change and Storm Detection. Our role is to take that, which was been under development by the government in concert with the DOD, and bring it to market so that enterprise customers are able to use it for their global security operation centers and be able to get what we call risk intelligence before a storm hits. So as you know, this has been an unprecedented year for hurricanes. We ran out of names with letters that went through Z. And the fact of the matter is it's probably the most rewarding thing I believe I've done, because it's, you know, we've got very large customers like Facebook and Shell Oil and others who are using this on a global basis, using our service. It's actually a service. In addition, we charge at the enterprise level about $20,000 per analyst per seat. But we also have a mobile offering we call Disaster Alert, which can be downloaded from either the App Store or Google Play. And that's actually free of charge. And the whole idea is to have as wide a coverage of populations around the world who can get information that might, in fact, minimize their risk as well as the risk of their property and other assets.
So that's really interesting. And one thought I had while you're describing kind of what Tenafit does and disaster aware and your partnership with the DOD throughout your career, right? Managing risk is always something that business leaders have to take into account. And now we're living in this unprecedented age where, you know, threats can kind of come in from anywhere. How are your customers looking at products like DisasterAware, and how are they looking at risk mitigation?
Well, that's a great question, Jeremy. And like many things, there aren't uniform answers. There are companies who are very sensitive to it. Since COVID, we've seen tremendous interest in supply chains and how do I maintain supply chain continuity. What we learned is that the value proposition that our customers are most concerned about is how do I protect my assets, how do I protect my employees. But it's only been recently that we had a technology that allowed us to deliver this information in real time and cost effectively. My feeling is, you know, this is something we do very well in the United States. We have a great communication infrastructure, and we will see very broad adoption, as we're already seeing, because people understand we live in an uncertain world, and that's not necessarily new. And it's all about not necessarily does it exist, but how do you deal with it? It's, you know, my theory is you got to assume bad stuff is going to happen about how do you plan, manage, and have protocols in place so that you're not running around like a chicken with your head cut off.
You know, a lot of people talking about climate change, or there's a lot of people talking about basically just all the chaos that's going on in the world today. I mean, do you think we're problem solvers and we're going to overcome a lot of these challenges?
I definitely feel we're in a very good position. I'm a great believer in leadership. And while I also, you know, encourage technology adoption and feel that with technology, we help mitigate a lot of things, both from a societal standpoint, but and also from a bad stuff happens standpoint. But at the end of the day, it's all about leadership and people who really do know how to make transitions, deal with things, and not delude themselves about what's really going on. I think delusion is a big part of the problem when you don't fix things. You know, it's the old story. I once heard, not to drop names, but I once heard Steve Jobs give a talk, which has stuck with me. This is probably 20 years ago, where Steve said, as the CEO of a company, you make 500 decisions a day. If you have a 50% batting average, you're doing great. The key is, when you make a bad decision, to recognize it as soon as possible and correct it. And I think that the reason I'm optimistic is because, especially with a lot of the online training programs, like what you're doing here, the more highly skilled the leaders are, the better the outcome is going to be. It can't always be. I mean, Sully Sullenberger didn't accidentally land that plane on the Hudson. That was years of experience, clearly an expert. And when confronted with what probably would have killed 9 out of 10 other people, he was able to save it. So I'm a great believer in people being trained. And being trained, not just how I always say, my belief is it's easy when things are going well. The real test is when they're not, because you're always going to have problems. I mean, COVID, there are many vacant office buildings here in Silicon Valley, but leaders took decisive action and found ways to work around it. And I read these studies that say people feel they're more productive than ever.
I want to go back maybe closer to the beginning. You started your career at IBM. You know, you were an engineer, but you didn't necessarily start out in computers, correct? You were working in thermodynamics and cooling systems. But what's your origin story?
That's another great.
And you don't have to go all the way back.
After I went to IBM, I'd had, you know, a master's degree in thermodynamics, and I had some elective courses at the Stanford Business. And then I was in the service for a while, and then I show up at IBM, and the HR guy hands me this blue jacket, which is my personnel jacket, and tells me to report to this manager who was responsible at that time for a mainframe development that was in a lot of trouble. He said, you know, report to this guy. And so I reported to this manager, and his name was Joe Tsai. I'll never forget him. He's just a great guy. I report to Joe Tsai, and I hand him my little blue jacket, and I said, I'm Bob Miller. I'm here to help you with your cooling problem. He supposedly, part of the problem was that he had a cooling problem. And he looks at me, he says, I don't have any blank cooling problem. Do you know how to use an oscilloscope? I said, yeah. He said, you know how to read schematics? I said, yeah. He said, well, this is your tech Angie, and you're now in charge of the memory system. And I always say my thermodynamics career lasted 10 minutes.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Bob Miller's going to talk about suspending disbelief and one of the most legendary stories of his career. The title of this podcast is Suspending Disbelief, one of my favorite stories you ever told me was your team was pitching the personal computer at IBM. And, you know, there was this comment about suspending disbelief, but I thought you could share that story with my listeners just because I thought it was powerful when you told it to me. It stays with me all the time. It's a remarkable story. And you know, I think it's a cool story too, because of, you know, the history and stuff like that, but I'd love for you to share it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So by way of background, one of the things over the years I've come to believe is that companies get in their comfort zone and the world is changing around them and they're reluctant to change because they have this comfort zone. And probably the best example, and I'm sure there have been many Harvard case studies about this, just which is, you know, Kodak refusing to believe that digital cameras and eventually, you know, as we know, smartphones were going to destroy the need for film. Kodak had made huge investments in film. They had research centers built around that, and they never really got out of their comfort zone, and the rest is history. So when we were at IBM on this PC task force, this is now circa 1979, and there were essentially three major teams. One team was acquire a company. The other team was figure out how to use the 370 architecture in a PC, even though, you know, we realized that was just IBM trying to stay in its comfort zone. And the third team was start with a blank sheet of paper and come up with the world's best PC. Forget anything else. Forget anything else ever existed. And so as part of that, I had studied the Apple II, which I considered the world's best PC at the time as a PC. So our group really studied that as kind of, this is the product we have to beat. And we learned during that they had gotten their operating system for the Apple II from a company called Digital Research. And we had, within our team, we had assignments. I was responsible for the system architecture and design. A guy named Don Estridge was responsible for the software. And he went and talked with Digital Research. He said, you know, I'm from IBM. We're doing a PC. We'd really like you to do the operating system. And the guys at Digital Research blew him off. They said, IBM will never build a PC. We're not going to waste our time. So Bill Gates had a small company, maybe 10 people, that had done what we didn't even call it an operating system. It was essentially a series of drivers for the IBM Display Writer, which was a word processor that used a display and was a very successful product. So Don Estridge decided to approach Bill Gates. And Bill Gates at that time was about 21 years old, had dropped out of Harvard. I mean, the story is pretty legendary. But Don Estridge came back and told us, I think this is the guy that should do the job. So when we went to present our solution to the corporate management committee, which was the CEO and his staff, and the CEO at that time was named Frank Carey. And I would have to say he was one of the best business executives that I've ever had the opportunity to observe and work with. He made decisions. He didn't procrastinate. And we're giving our presentation and we're breaking all the rules. You know, I had shown we're going to build a system that doesn't use a single IBM component. And the reason was we didn't want any of the IBM overheads in our costs. Don Estridge gets up to give his presentation about the software. And he says to Frank Carey, we've chosen this company. We feel they're very good. They're run by a fellow named Bill Gates. They did work for the Display Writer, and the people in Austin who were responsible for the Display Writer are very, very happy with them. So Frank Carey starts asking Don Estridge the usual IBM interview questions. Well, how old is this guy, Bill Gates? I'm laughing because Don said he's 21. And the look on Frank Carey's face was like, we haven't ever depended on a 21-year-old in the history of this company. And then he said, where did he go to school? And Don Estrich says, well, where did he graduate? And Don Estrich says, well, he dropped out of college. And you can see Frank was like, why are you wasting my time, was the look on his face. And Don Estrich, to his credit, said, Frank, for the next 30 minutes, I want you to suspend disbelief. And Frank took that and said, okay, Don, go ahead. Now, the decision we were looking for was how much resource would each of these three things get. So the buy a company team fell on their face because they didn't know I had already shown this group the Apple II. And it was a sales guy that was running that team. And this is really all about leadership and integrity. And this was a guy who was clearly on the fast track in sales. And when it came for them to make their recommendation, he had rehearsed every possible question. He was so smooth in answering, but he had forgotten one. And when he got done, he recommended Commodore, that we buy Commodore. And Frank Carey looked at him and he said, are they the best? And you could see of all the questions this guy had rehearsed, he didn't expect that one. And he paused for a whole minute. There was dead silence in the room. And he said, no, they're not the best. And Frank Carey said, who is the best? He said, Apple. Why would the IBM not buy anyone but the best? And the sales guy said, well, the lawyers won't let me. That was the end of that. And then, the build the micro mainframe or whatever they were calling themselves, they got allocated 300 headcount out of that meeting. They were allocated 300 headcount. Now, remember, this is the stay in the comfort zone group. Our group, which was, we're going to revolutionize everything, even though IBM has billions invested in semiconductor facilities, we're not going to use a single IBM semiconductor because we can't afford it. We're going to go to the outside market for all our components. We got 30 headcount, and the rest is history. The 300 headcount project never materialized into anything. And I think, the IBM PC became the market share leader. And so that's what I mean when I say sometimes you have to suspend disbelief and realize you have to do things in a different way. You've got to get out of your comfort zone. I constantly push people that work for me. First of all, identify your comfort zone and make sure you're not making your decisions just to stay in that comfort zone.
It's just such a great story every time I hear it, and I don't think it'll ever get old.
I'll add one thing to it. When they analyzed how did the Titanic hit an iceberg, what they figured out was the way they used to do those transoceanic megaliners was they would leave Liverpool, set their compass heading, and just stick to it. And that's how they hit the iceberg, because they were not going to they were not going to change their compass heading. Many times when companies are successful, and I've seen this time and time again, they believe that success has to be maintained, and they set that direction, and they become very resistant to change. And IBM had a theory of what they called the wild ducks, which are the ducks that didn't just stick with the flock and would cut out on their own and look for better places that were, had more food or whatever. You need to encourage that in a company. That has to become part of the culture, not just we let Harry go do something and look at this, it was a big success. The way you keep your culture vibrant and attractive to others is to be able to demonstrate that you are open to innovative ideas and implementing technology in unique ways and even marketing programs. The world is, if you just think of how the sales organizations have transformed themselves from relationship selling, large sales forces, to now depending so much for online, even when you're dealing with the largest corporations. So that's my final thought.
I want to go to I want to go to Data General and the DG1, which it wasn't the first laptop, right, brought to market. But what was unique about the DG1 and that program that you worked on?
So it was the first laptop that was fully IBM PC compatible. So it could run any IBM PC application. Every other one that had been introduced prior required the side to run on it. And our ground rule for the DG1 was you could take a floppy disk, those are the days when you used the software came off floppy disk, and put it in a DG1 and it would run the same way as on your PC. So therefore, you had thousands of application developers by that time. This was like 1985. If you went to them and said, you've got to modify your software to run on my machine, that was a non-starter. Because software developers want to go the highest volume thing. They don't want to have 20 versions of their application. They want to have one version. So that was the breakthrough of the DG1, that it could run whatever you were running on your PC, you could run it on the DG1, unmodified.
It's kind of like the first Android phone of its day.
Yeah.
And what was it like bringing that product to market, and what was the outcome?
Well, the product was, we had a development lab in Japan, and we used them to develop the product primarily because most of the components would be sourced in Japan. So things like surface mounted motherboards at that time were only of, you know, we studied, or I studied, I bought a VCR. You may remember this, or you may be too young. I bought a VCR from Panasonic, and I took it apart to look at how they did the components, because it was about the form factor of what we wanted to do with the PC. And I discovered this double-sided surface-mounted technology. So that became key for two reasons. You know, you could have a compact form factor, and it was very, very, very low power consumption. That's why the Panasonic portable VCR was a portable VCR. So I went to Panasonic, and I negotiated a contract where they would build the manufacturing equipment for the DG1. And we gave them a $5 million contract to develop it. It was an interesting experience because their manufacturing line was all robotics. So that was key. That was very key. The product, we had this LCD that was monochrome. And after I left DG, they didn't really invest to make it multicolor. And they wound up falling behind in terms of, I can't emphasize enough how important the multicolor is to everything. And the management that stayed after I left just lost interest and never really advanced the product. So it never became anything but it's in the computer museum here in Mountain View, but it was never a great business success.
Yeah, one of the favorite images I have in my memory is the one of the journalist. I think he's in the Middle East next to a camel, you know, working from his DG1.
That's real. He was a New York Times journalist who had embedded himself with the Taliban. That's when they were fighting the Russians in Afghanistan.
Holy cow. It's still on the internet. I find it all the time.
When we come back, Mr. Miller talks about how he took over MIPS Computer Systems as CEO. It took a fledgling Silicon Valley microprocessor startup public, and how its innovation is used in many of the products we interact with today.
After DG, you went to MIPS. What attracted you to MIPS, and you know, what was it about, you know, moving from the East Coast to Silicon Valley to take over this company that really made you want to leave DG and take this risk?
So I had at one point been responsible for IBM's whole microprocessor strategy. And part of that strategy was RISC technology. And I could see the potential for RISC because one of my beliefs is the ideal machine has one part. And what RISC technology brought to microprocessors was an incredible simplification in terms of the number of transistors you needed to actually achieve higher performance, less transistors, less power. The problem, and the reason I didn't support a big program in IBM at the time, because IBM did have this project called the 801, was that there was no software for it. And in fact, when I went to data generator, we had a laboratory in Austin, a development lab, and they were proposing MIPS-based RISC processor workstation. And what Data General's number one competitor was Digital Equipment Corporation. And what Digital Equipment had that Data General lacked was a lot of application software that ran on their systems. But the world was changing, and what was changing was Unix was coming along. But looked at the MIPS workstation project, I actually killed it because we couldn't afford the software plan that would be necessary to get the applications that would allow us to make it competitive. I love the technology. I love the idea of it, but I didn't see how we could ever afford to drive application software toward the machine. Fast forward, the MIPS guys call me up and say, "Hey, we're looking for a CEO. Are you interested?" And I said, "Yeah, I just killed that project. Why would I be interested?" And they said, "Well, at least hear us out." So they sent John Hennessy, who, for those of you on this call, may not realize, went on to become the president of Stanford, and Skip Stritter, and a VC who had been an investor in MIPS. And MIPS was, I had asked them to send me their financials. So Skip and Hennessy came over, and they brought some really good data about the performance and where the project was and why they could solve the problem. And I knew there was an opportunity because people felt very trapped by Intel. And this was a much better technology. This was literally jet engines versus internal combustion engines. And so I was so intrigued by the team. I was actually going to California because I was being interviewed to be the CEO of a semiconductor software company. And I thought, well, go visit MIPS in the morning and I'll go to the semiconductor software company in the afternoon. And what I discovered was true genius when I went to MIPS. I never went to the software company. I stayed at MIPS all day and then to dinner. But in IBM, we had estimated when we were looking at implementing RISC technology, we had estimated it would take 1,000 man years of software development to develop the software around the 801 processor. And when I was at MIPS, I said, "How did you guys solve the compiler problem, which is key to being able to run any applications on your architecture?" And they said, "Fred Chow." And I said, "What's a Fred Chow?" And they said, "He was one of John Hennessy's graduate students, and we hired him, and Fred Chow did all the compilers." So I went and met Fred Chow, and from that, I decided this is absolute proof that one genius is worth 1,000 of anything else. And that's another thing to think about. One genius is worth 1,000 of anything else. Fred Chow was a genius. The team at MIPS were genius level. And the rest is history. Today, there are probably, 100 to 1,000 times more MIPS architecture processors shipped than Intel. Now, ARM, which is also a RISC processor, has come on and probably ships more processors than MIPS. But what we were able to do with the MIPS processor was revolutionize the gaming industry because of the lower number of transistors. We could manufacture it for a much lower cost. And we had set up through partnerships five major semiconductors who would produce the part. Whereas for those of you who know, Intel would not allow anybody to license and build their version of their chips. And there's another lesson here. You cannot artificially constrain competition. Everyone who has ever tried that has failed. The world is going to migrate to what's best. They're just going to feel trapped if you try to come up with something that locks them in when they don't want to be locked in. That's why open source software has become such a great success. And the companies that didn't figure that out have fallen way behind. Nobody considers Oracle today a real innovator of anything because they still take this proprietary approach.
And so you took MIPS public, and I think at least one thing that I understood about, there was more than just the technology there, and you just talked about it, which is that you developed strong channels to market. And that seemed to be kind of unique for your time. Was MIPS also a pioneer in that sense as well, in terms of how you guys actually generate revenue, build partnerships, built your business model?
Yeah. So when I got to MIPS, that's a very good point. The business model was MIPS would pay semiconductor foundries to build their processors, and then MIPS would, they would pay on a per wafer basis. And you can almost say it ran counter to what MIPS really needed, because there was no incentive for the semiconductor foundry to improve yields. They would say, I want $1,400 a wafer, and if I get two chips off this wafer, that's all on you. So we flipped the business model. The business model became, we'll license you the designs. You'll be able to sell them to pay us a royalty. And then we'll also allow you as a licensee to use all our software for a price, like the compilers and so forth. So that way there was economic incentive not only to produce the chips at the lowest possible cost, but also to distribute them as widely as they could, because now they were just paying us, I think it was like a 10% royalty initially. That eventually got down to about a 5% royalty. But the whole idea, and that is key, whenever you're negotiating very important licenses or any agreement, you always have to put yourself on the other side of the table. Because again, if I take all the margin out, if it's a zero-sum game, this was one of the big issues I had with my boss at Data General. He had grown up in a culture at Digital, which is where he came from, where the whole idea was it didn't matter if the other guys made money as long as you made money. And if you play that zero-sum game, there's no incentive for people to really do it. I mean, I used to say the problem with the Microsoft model for the PC manufacturers was they had to pay 90 cents to get 10 cents back. And Microsoft was getting 50 cents. So they were essentially working for Microsoft. And you have to, and that's why, when we first introduced the IBM PC, there were hundreds of PC manufacturers who all went out of business because they couldn't make enough margin to produce the product, distribute the product, and just become a vehicle for Microsoft to make tons of money. So the semiconductor licensing program we put in place was, in fact, a total revolution. And I still remember when it was announced that I had licensed NEC, Andy Grove, who was CEO of Intel, called me up and was screaming at me over the phone that I had let NEC survive and he had spent the last 5 years trying to kill them. And I actually thought that was pretty funny. But it was very important. Key thing, always make sure your business partner is going to be profitable and make money. Because if your business partner can't make a profit, they're not going to remain your business partner. And finally, what happened in the PC world, when you got down to like maybe four or five major PC suppliers, they had leverage on Microsoft.
In the final chapter of this episode, Bob Miller will share his experiences leading various startups after his career at MIPS, as well as new technologies that business leaders should be paying attention to.
So after MIPS, you went on to invest in and found several startups. What is it about working at startups that you get excited about? That I mean, you've pretty much have stayed in the startup game ever since MIPS.
Well, there are two reasons. One is I suffer from CEO disease, which is that once you're your own boss, it's very hard to work for somebody else. And at SGI, I was working for a CEO who I thought was not effective. And I kind of sealed my own fate there when they were going to acquire Cray. Then made a big speech at a board meeting and said, this is the only time I've ever watched somebody take a poison pill themselves. And I think history bore out that I was pretty right about that. And the argument they gave is we're going to be the kings of tactical computing. And I said, well, in my mind, you're going to be kings of the dump at a board meeting, which didn't sit well with the then CEO. But the key about, so when I left Data General, I had been responsible for an organization that had 18,000 people. When I got to MIPS, I was responsible for an organization that had 40 people. And I found out I enjoyed managing 40 people a lot more than I enjoyed managing 18,000. And that's stuck with me. When I was at IBM, I used to say it's like being on the bridge of an aircraft carrier, looking down at fishing boats in terms of the competition. And what I concluded is the guys in the fishing boats are having a lot more fun. And that's my feeling about startups, is they're a lot more fun. You're a lot closer to the action. You can make decisions quickly. Never are the high so high or the low so low. And so you know what you're getting into. And I think that that's just, you have to be someone who's willing to accept the risk and understand that you're not going to be, there's no safety net. You're on the high wire.
Even at Sentient, we used to always say that, we know which day we're going to die. If nothing changes, you can map out the exact day that, you're going to run out of cash and that's it. It's all over, right?
Very frankly, I'd rather flip that around. Hmm. You know exactly how you can make sure you don't die when you're in a startup. Then it becomes, once you know that, can you, because startups are all about execution. And, getting back to, there's no room for self-delusion. You have to be very, you have to have a very good financial person who can help you. I have a rule. I want to see three options for everything. Don't just come to me with one option. Show me three options.
No, I think that's smart. Getting to just some more, kind of fun questions. You mentioned in your bio that you like to think that every piece of technology that somebody touches, you are somehow a part of. What do you mean by that?
Let me restate that. I believe during a day, you will touch a product that includes a technology that I was part of. When I was at IBM, we did all the pioneering work on flat panel displays. MIPS processors today are distributed in literally millions, if not billions, of different products. That architecture, even in your appliances, because they embed the architecture with other things and gate arrays and so forth. Hmm. So I was at a financial conference one time, Goldman Sachs, right after MIPS went public, and I made that statement. I said, in 10 years, you're not going to be able to go through a day without touching something that will have a MIPS processor in some form embedded in it.
In terms of just technologies that you've watched over the years, what's really surprised you in terms of a technology that's been really successful?
That's a great question also.
It's always good when your dad says that's a great question. It makes me feel good.
Where was I really surprised? I guess it's crazy, but I can't say that any of the major weren't things that I thought were possible. I think that, the time I saw the first version of a cell phone that Motorola produced, even though it weighed about a pound and a half, I said, this is going to be really big. We talked about the Apple II and what could happen with PCs. I think if I had to say what has amazed me is the fact that that smartphones have now, you know, if you think of it, especially the new generation of the Apple 12, I guess it's the 12, they're more powerful than the mainframes that I had worked on when I first got to IBM by factors of 100. It's not even, you know, people used to say, well, they're like a mainframe. In the case of our products, you know, the large customers have what we call GSOCs, Global Secure Operations Centers. And because there's so much power in the smartphone, our thing is, you can put a GSOC in your pocket. So everything that's in that GSOC, you can replicate on that phone that's going to be in your pocket. And if you go to our website and look at it, you'll see, you know, hurricane tracking, COVID, you name it, all can be seen on your smartphone in seconds. So that's the part, you know, I knew phones, portable phones would be important, but I couldn't have predicted what would happen in terms of, you know, being able to run hundreds of thousands of applications at lightning speed. Just amazing to me.
So on the other side of that, you know, what are some things that you think our listeners should kind of pay attention to in terms of new technologies on the horizon?
Well, artificial intelligence, clearly. I mean, anybody who ignores artificial intelligence right now is doing it at their own peril. It's just going to have such an incredible impact because, you know, it builds off all the other things that are happening. It builds off the fact that low-cost computing is still on an exponential curve. The cloud and being able to access. I mean, I surprise myself about how little information I keep local to me versus being in the cloud. Well, if you say, you know, and we use artificial intelligence because one of the things we're trying to do is predict what's the path of a hurricane going to be. And how do we take 15 years worth of data, run it through machine learning, apply artificial intelligence, and provide a storm track to your mobile device. And on top of that, you know, one of the things that we do for Facebook is provide what we call PID, personal incident, which is a euphemism for how many people were killed or injured. Well, the way you get PID is you have to literally go through 50,000 pages of material from around the globe in seconds. And we're just at the beginnings. This is going to grow exponentially. I mean, self-driving cars, you know, we're only a couple of years away from artificial intelligence, self-driving trucks. So that's definitely something that you really need to stay on top of and how you can apply it, you know, effectively, most likely to reduce cost and, you know, human automation is really, really a key topic.
The last thing I want to ask you before we close out, and it's one thing that I've always noticed about, you always seem to maintain, you know, this optimistic attitude, even when things get tough. You know, what could you impart on our listeners in terms of, you know, having that kind of attitude and why it's powerful?
Well, I think that I would actually describe my score in a combination of a level of optimism, belief in myself, and perseverance. Perseverance wins the day. But by persevering and not giving up, many times I'll be in a discussion with my guys and we'll be talking about what it's going to take to solve a problem. And I said, is it going to require breaking any laws of physics? I said, if it's going to require breaking a law of physics, don't waste your time. But if you can convince yourself that the solution you're trying to achieve is just going to take some very good work and creative thinking and you persevere, then you're going to get to the solution. That's not optimism. That's saying I have some basic ground rules I live by. I'm not a fool. I mean, if it breaks the law of physics, I'm not going to keep working on it. There are things where you just have to say, hey, this is never going to work. So it's very important for you to be optimistic. You can at least describe why
maybe, like I said, maybe optimism was the wrong word, but you always had this sense of you knew where you wanted to go, and you know, you could believe in yourself and you could believe in your team, and you could really drive forward with that belief, right? Which is pretty cool.
Oh, and you bring up a very important point that shouldn't be lost. The team has to be with you. If everyone on your team is telling you, this is a dumb idea, I don't think we can do it, maybe you ought to stop and think about what you're doing. You have to bring the team with you. They have to believe you as well. Surround yourself with really smart people. Listen to what they have to say.
Dad, this was fun. I'm glad we had a chance to do this. Obviously, you know, you've been a role model for me, you know, whether I've told you or not. And, you know, I really do. I thank you for doing this with me.
We'll do anything to help you succeed. So it's
good. Even do a podcast.
Okay. Go Niners.